You've stopped in at the Guidepost, brought to you by the American Saltwater Guides Association. Stock up on gear, grab a coffee at the counter, and get ready to hear incredible fish stories from the best captains on the East Coast and thought-provoking conversations with stakeholders and policymakers working to protect these fisheries. This podcast is presented by Costa Sunglasses.
Hey everyone, the podcast you're about to listen to is a recording from a guest speaker at our last Fishery Science Symposium that we hosted in New Orleans, Louisiana last month. We hosted our third Fishery Science Symposium with the goal of further unifying the angling community, fostering productive discussion, and inspiring stewardship across sectors. Our science symposiums foster a collaborative learning environment for industry leaders that includes guides, anglers, brand representatives, small business owners, media scientists, state representatives, you name it. If you're a stakeholder in the fishing and outdoor industry, you have a place in these conversations. Our fall 2024 event was the first of its kind for the Louisiana angling community, and it was largely a great success. So we appreciate everyone who came out, but these events are intended to be a multimedia event. So you can access a full library of presentation coverage on the ASGA YouTube. You can see those videos. You can also obviously listen to them all as individual podcast episodes. We had a great lineup of speakers. Dr. Marcus Dryman, a fisheries ecologist at the Mississippi State University, stopped by to talk about Jack Revall and a proactive approach for an underappreciated fishery. We also had Chris Shibley and Jason Adrians from LDWF check in to talk about the latest on redfish in Louisiana and the LA Creel program. Ben Meadows, who is an economist and professor at the University of Alabama, Birmingham, stopped by give a pretty engaging presentation about the untold economic impacts of redfish in Louisiana. And then Lu Yen Cho from the Got One app, as many of you know, stopped by to talk about how apps and artificial intelligence are changing the game for fisheries. So be sure to check out each speaker from the lineup. And without further ado, enjoy a digital check-in to the third ASGA Fishery Science Symposium.
The sort of tagline I've been using for these guys is that it's time for us to take a proactive approach to protect what is very definitely an underappreciated fish. And I think I'd like to start off by saying this whole project was not my idea. Like, I started working on a little subset of this Jack Revall thing. Really, the bones of this project was inspired, co-developed, and ultimately financially supported by the Lower Keys Guide Association, and now by ASGA. So it's a great example to me of fishermen bringing us a problem and asking us to help them fix it. This isn't just some academic exercise that we dreamed up just to see what we could see. This is important to a lot of people. So I'm excited to kind of walk you through the history of what this looks like for us. So where would we start? We'll start at the beginning. I am a fisheries ecologist. I'm a professor at Mississippi State University. This means I work on things like life history, determining how old fish get, when they mature, when they reproduce. I work on things like trophic ecology, what they eat, how that affects food webs, movements, migrations. And I work on a variety of species, right? A lot of reef fishes, red snapper, greater amberjack, triggerfish, a lot of coastal pelagics, cobia, triple tail, redfish. But honestly, most of my work and what I'm probably most known for is my work on coastal sharks. That's kind of been my passion for the past 20 years. And that's really where my bread and butter is understanding the role of coastal sharks in the northern Gulf of Mexico and understanding how life history can dovetail into better management and ultimately conservation for those species. But about 10 years ago, I was interested in studying this individual ray in Mobile Bay called the Smooth Butterfly Ray. And in order to get that project funded, I couched the idea of studying relatively abundant, unregulated, and underappreciated species in Mobile Bay. So the Smooth Butterfly Ray, throw in the gaff topsail catfish, of course, and Jack Revall. I said, you know, I don't think we know really anything about Jack Revall, so let's study the diet and the age structure of those three species, right? And so to do that, I turned to a collaboration that we've had for probably 20 years, the Alabama Deep Sea Fishing Rodeo. So for those of you that might be familiar with this tournament, this was recognized by the Guinness Book of World Records in 2012 as the world's largest fishing tournament, right? It's an enormous deal. I've worked as a judge there for over 10 years and as a graduate student there before that, but it's my kind of tournament. I really, really like this tournament. It's a blue collar tournament. Your $40 ticket gets you entry into the grand prize, where a random drawing wins you a fully specced out contender bay boat. And that's if you landed a gaff topsail catfish or the biggest blue marlin you've ever seen. So it's really, it's a special tournament for that way. But they bring in a lot of fish, right? So for fisheries guys like me who are looking to pull otoliths or look at stomach contents, this three-day tournament is a fantastic opportunity to get a lot of samples. Right? And Jack Crevalle, as you can see in some of these images, Jack Crevalle is one of the main species caught and weighed in at the Alabama Deep Sea Fishing Rodeo. Actually, if you could go back, I would say these are images from Garden and Gun magazine, but I chose them very specifically, mostly for this beautiful young lady here and one of her best friends. This is my daughter when she was young. She's 17 now, and that's Dr. Powers, my graduate advisor. That's his daughter. They have been working with us, you know, helping us sample fish at the Alabama Deep Sea Fishing Rodeo since they were a little girl. So I really, I appreciate that rodeo for allowing that. So the Alabama Deep Sea Fishing Rodeo, right? Turns out Mobile Bay is really a stronghold, a population stronghold for these jacks. When we talk to people in other parts of the world, they say, man, we don't see jacks like we used to. We don't get that in Mobile Bay. Like, we think, man, there's so many jacks in Mobile Bay. Like, it's a good place to be a jack, right? And as it turns out, the ADSFR weighs in hundreds of jacks each year, and they're all these guys, right? We don't see any of these guys. So, quick table to show you over 6 years, so from 2018 to 2023, you can see the number of jacks weighed in. It ranges from about 100 fish to almost 200 fish a year. So again, for a guy like me taking samples, excellent opportunity to get a whole lot of data in one stop. You can see the mean size of those jacks, very similar. The average size of the jacks weighed in is about 23 pounds, right? But you don't see small jacks. The smallest jack is still going to be more than 10 pounds. And to win the jack category, you got to be weighing in a 30 pounder, right? So again, big, big, big fish. Next, please. So what I was interested in understanding are very basic fisheries biology questions about jacks. We didn't know how old they get. And to do a stock assessment for red drum or any species on the planet, you really need to know the age structure of the population. It's like fisheries biology 101. And again, this is information that we didn't know about jacks. So to determine how old a fish is, and you guys may already know this, you have to pull out this little bone inside their head. It's called an otolith. But again, with all these dead fish, we had access to the otoliths from each individual. We could pull those otoliths, we take them back to the lab, and we section them on a saw. Now, just like a tree, when you cut it down, you see a tree trunk, it has these concentric growth rings. And we all know that those equate to the age of the tree, right? You can count the number of rings, and that tells you how old the tree is. An otolith is the exact same way. So if you see in that first panel, that's an age, what we call an age zero fish, very small fish. In panel B, that is a, the little dots are hard to see. It's a four-year-old fish. Panel C is a nine-year-old fish. And panel D is a 20-year-old fish. So it's incredible when you think about the age structure of different fish populations. We know some fish are super long-lived. We know that the mahi that you gaffed the other day, they are 4 years old, 5 years tops. Biggest mahi you've ever seen in your life is a five-year-old. That 40-pound triple tail that one of y'all caught here in Louisiana a couple years ago, that big guy, I pulled his otoliths, that particular fish. That's a five-year-old fish. So fish that grow really fast can sustain a heavier harvest, whereas fish like this, this is what we would consider a moderately long-lived species. This is the kind of statistical model that illustrates the size of these fish as a function of their age. And basically, once you get to a fish that's about this big, it could be anywhere from 10 to 20 years old. And again, this is work that we did from those samples at the rodeo, and this was stuff that science didn't really know yet. So these are relatively long-lived fish, right? We also looked at their stomach contents. It's not news to you guys to know that Jack Crevall eat whatever the hell they want, you know? They eat a lot of fish. And looking at their diets using DNA barcoding, we determined they eat a list of fish that's about that long, right? So they have a really important role that they play in regulating coastal ecosystems. So that's kind of part one. That's how I started to really get thinking about these jacks. Honestly, it was just a way to do some of the stingray work that I was interested in. But after I did the age and growth, I'm like, man, these are cool fish. They're really long-lived, a lot longer, older than I thought. They eat everything, which is cool. They're not specialist feeders. They're very generalist. And so part two of this story is about me making some new friends. Basically, I was at a meeting, scientific meeting, a researcher from Florida International University named Dr. Rehaj comes up to me and she's like, oh, Marcus, you know, I heard you're studying jacks. And I kind of laughed. I said, yeah, we do a lot of work on greater amberjack. We're doing some tagging. And she's like, no, Jack Crevall. I was like, oh yeah, I am. Actually, I didn't know anyone else really gave a rip about Jack Crevall, but yeah, you know, it's a really cool fish as it turns out. And she's like, yeah, I know. We have a PhD student and we were approached by the folks from the Lower Keys Guide Association. And what these guides in the Keys were saying is that a fish that was once considered a trip saver for them, if they can't put their client on a bonefish or a tarpon or a permit, they could always put them on a nice jack. What was once considered a trip saver is now harder and harder and harder and harder to find. So she said, I'm really interested in knowing what you're finding with jacks up in, you know, up in Mobile. She's like, we're seeing smaller and smaller jacks down in the Keys. And I kind of laughed. I said, man, jacks in Mobile Bay are born at this size. Like, we only see this size jack, right? So all of a sudden it's like, maybe we should get together. Maybe we should pool our collective resources and start looking at this fish through a more holistic way. And this is a little essay published in a magazine called Fisheries, and the title is Poor Jack, The Plight of a Forgotten Fish. This is Dr. Gervasi. When she was a PhD student, she was studying this fish, and she's like, man, this fish is really important to the guys in the Lower Keys Guide Association, but no one really cares about it. It's not regulated. We don't know basic science about it. All of these things, right? So on that plot on the far left side, and you can't see it really well, but what it shows is they went down and they interviewed these guides in the Lower Keys. They say, in your opinion, what's causing the population of jacks to plummet? The answers given by the guides are shown here on this plot. They said things like prey loss, right? The available prey that jacks like, that's drying up. They said recreational overharvest, people killing jacks just to use them for shark bait, things like that. Like, that's driving the population down. Commercial harvest. There is a small commercial harvest of jacks in Florida, as well as a whole host of other things, including a cold weather snap. Next, please. So one of the things Carissa was interested in doing is a stock assessment. And so Jason and LDAWF guys, Chris, are going to talk a little bit about things like that, how we assess the status of a stock of fish. And this plot on the left-hand side is to say that it's kind of complicated. It requires a lot of data. It requires data about the relative abundance of a stock over time. It requires data about the age structure, the trophic ecology. It requires information about the catch, in addition to a whole host of other things. Which is to say, if you want to do a stock assessment on a species, you need piles and piles and piles of data. But turns out for Jack Crevall, we don't have that. Just like Tony said, it is absolutely what we consider a data-poor species. So Carissa was unable to take the approach on the left, right? We just don't have the data for that. So she took the approach on the right, which is essentially saying, the only information I have about Jack Crevall is what I learned from these guides in the Florida Keys. And so I'm going to use that with a combination of these new kind of statistical and mathematical tools and see if we can do what's called a data poor stock assessment for this species in South Florida. And that's what she did. And that's what two of these plots are summarizing very well. Now, again, these are terms that you guys are familiar with. But on the left-hand plot, we're talking about something called overfished, you know, a status of a stock being overfished or not. And on the right-hand side, we're talking about the status of a plot, a status of a stock as being undergoing overfishing. So in other words,
I have a PhD in this.
Yeah.
Overfished and overfishing sound like the simplest terms in the world. I mean, the most confusing terms in the world. They're super simple. Overfished is talking about the population. How many are out? Overfishing is the rate at which we're removing.
That's correct.
That's the easiest way to.
Overfished is the status. It's the current condition of a stock. Overfishing is a rate that leads to a population that's overfished. So you can have combinations. You can have a population that is overfished but not experiencing overfishing. You can have a population that is not overfished but is experiencing overfishing. You know, what Carissa showed for jacks is that the population was both overfished and experiencing overfishing. Overfished means that this value is down here below this line. Overfishing means this value is in this quadrant over here. So based on the very limited data we had for Jack Crevalle and these data poor stock assessments, the results are not encouraging in the Keys. Basically, this fish that's so important to so many people's livelihoods is not doing well. And we as fishery scientists and fisheries managers don't really know crap about it. So not great news, right? Next slide, please. So, brief recap. These are the three studies that I kind of talked about. On the left, you know, we did the age and growth, understanding the age structure of the population, understanding what the population eats. On that middle paper, Carissa did her due diligence, had these in-depth interviews with these guides down in the Keys. And then on the right, you know, she went through the process of doing this kind of data limited stock assessment that says, Jackson, the Florida Keys are not doing great. So that really brings me to the exciting part of this talk, part three. You know, what can we do collectively as fisheries folks, as guides, as just interested people, interested in these species? Like, what can we do? Well, one of the lowest hanging fruit things we can do is just find out more about their movement patterns. So if that stock in South Florida and the Florida Keys is doing really poorly, but we know jacks tend to do okay where Cody is, at least based on his pictures, right? We know jacks in Mobile Bay doing pretty well. So what's the connectivity between those stocks? Like, is it possible for these stocks that are healthy to somewhat eventually start replenishing that stock down in the Keys, right? We don't know if that's possible until we know more about the movements and migrations. And one of the ways we can do that is by using tags. And another way we can do that's by using transmitters.
Dad, how badass this fish is. But those bottom two kids both have bloody knuckles from that fish actually screaming and reel out. And the guy on the top broke a rod in the morning, and the guy on the left quit about in the middle of the morning.
And the guy on the left has that fish has a tag in it, right? So that's really what I'm talking about. That's one of the ways we can, in a very simple approach, understand where these fish are moving to and from. Awesome stuff. So there's the conventional tags, right? You catch a fish, you stick it with the tag, and you throw it back. Now, as you guys know, for that to provide any useful information, that fish then has to be recaptured. And we know that doesn't happen every day, but let's say you put out 1,000 tags. Hopefully you'll get maybe, I don't know, 50 back, something like that. That'd be great. But that's after you put out 1,000 tags, right? It takes a lot of effort. But it's a relatively low upfront investment, right? Another approach is telemetry. Telemetry is simply measuring something remotely. So you can use acoustic telemetry. The white sharks you're talking about that Greg studies up in New England, those are tagged with satellite tags. Now, those tags cost more money, but you're going to get information from those fish regardless of whether or not those fish are recaptured. So the way acoustic telemetry works, it's kind of a three-stage process. You have to have an acoustic receiver, which is also called a hydrophone. That's something out in the environment that's listening for acoustic tags, right? Then in the middle, you have to actually implant this little tag. It's a transmitter. On the right, you can see me getting ready to open up this jack, stick one of those transmitters in, sew it up real quick, and throw it back. Now, if and when that jack swims within about 1,000 feet of one of those receivers, that receiver is going to detect that jack and make a recording. And then we go back to that hydrophone a couple times a year, download all that data, and we can see which jacks have been swimming around and where they've been going. Now, these receivers are expensive. So what smart folks do is they say, hey, why don't I put out some receivers, and you put out some receivers, and you put out some receivers, and we'll all share, right? Let's all play nicely together. And we can establish these cooperative arrays. And this is just an image of a cooperative array that's been established in the Florida Keys, right? Next, please. On the left-hand panel, you can't see it too well, but essentially, once you have these arrays, you can hear from tons of different species that have been tagged with acoustic transmitters. Greg Scommel's white sharks, as it turns out, got detected on that array in the Florida Keys. Sawfish, bluefin tuna, dusky sharks, permit, albies, all these things can be detected on these arrays once they're in place. This is a very complicated way of showing the detection history. So on this x-axis here, we've got like a 5-year period. And every time you see one of these dots, it's a detection of that individual species on that individual hydrophone array. And what you notice, or you would notice maybe, is right down here, it says Craval Jack. The actual name's Craval Jack. We just call them Jack Craval or Jacks, right? So down here are Jacks. You can see there's a few Jacks that have been detected on that South Florida array. Well, when it comes to white sharks, everyone on the planet is putting acoustic tags in white sharks, right? No one cares about the jacks. The only people tagging jacks with acoustic tags are Carissa and myself. So these are Carissa's fish that she tagged in South Florida that were then detected on that array. Now, here's a little image showing you what those fish did, right? So because we have the advantage of these cooperative rays, we're able to track these fish that Carissa's tagging down there in South Florida and watch them as they make their way all across the Gulf of Mexico. Now, I'm gonna let this video play again. I can't stress how cool this is. So as someone who spent time tagging tarpon, big, highly migratory species, you tag those suckers, you tag a tarpon in South Florida, it'll swim up the west coast of Florida, it'll go to the mouth of the river, but that's gonna turn around and go back. Right? And tarpon tagged in Texas, they're going to go up the Texas coast, they're going to hit the river mouth, and then they're going to turn around and go back. These jacks that we're tagging in South Florida are making their way up the west coast of Florida, into Mississippi, Alabama, across the river, and into Texas. And this summer, we went out with Yako Lucas in Port O'Connor in an attempt to get some tags out on jacks down there to see if they're going even further. We think these jacks may be going into Mexico. So, yet another reason why I have fallen in love with this fish. Extremely cool. Like, I did not expect these jacks to be moving at the scale that they're moving. And this is only based on 30 or 40 tagged fish. Like, imagine if we had a couple hundred transmitter telemetried jacks swimming around, we'd have a better idea. I mean, are they going up the east coast of Florida too? We suspect they probably are. So, lots more that can be done right here.
And then quick other thing, but in the context of management, which is where a lot of this Correct. Is super valuable, look at those red dots on the right where that red stops. I guide right on the other edge of where that red stops. We have this incredible migration that people book an entire year out to participate in.
Yeah.
But if the state is looking at like, wow, everything's incredible, look at these millions of jacks here. What if those jacks only go from about where I am to South Carolina?
Exactly.
That's a very different conversation.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah, so where does that leave us? Where are we right now? Well, I started getting interested in jacks in about 2017, just like I said, kind of as a side project. And since 2017, every day, you know, I'm learning more and more about how cool these fish are. So it's not just me that thinks this anymore, right? So in April of 2024, Florida Sportsman wrote an article about jacks, and their conclusion was, it's time for us to be proactive rather than reactive. Just what I've been saying for about 5 years now. I mean, absolutely, like, there are places where these jack craval are doing really well. Let's not wait until they're doing really poorly before we decide to do something better, right? So to that end, I talked to the guys at the Alabama Deep Sea Fishing Rodeo, and I said, hey man, I've learned everything I can from these dead jacks. We've done the age structure of the population. We've learned about their gut contents. Like, there's no reason to keep on killing all these jacks. Like, I'm all about killing fish that we're going to eat. All about it. But when it comes to wanton waste, I don't know. I don't know anybody who's a big fan of that. And what I do know is every year at that rodeo, when there's 150 dead jacks, I literally see somebody in a forklift come scoop them all up and put them in the dumpster. So I say, hey guys, we can do better than that, right? Like, if we think back to these photos from the 30s and 40s and 50s of walls of tarpon hanging up on nails. We don't do that anymore. Yeah, we kill a few tarpon sometimes, sure. But by and large, we catch a tarpon, we let it go. Because no one's trying to eat a tarpon. Why aren't we doing the same thing, right? But these things take time, right? And it takes time to change attitudes. It took me a year leaning on these guys. Even though I've worked with these guys for 20 years, finally, right before the tournament this year, they said, you know what, Marcus, we think this is a stupid idea, but we like you, so we're going to do it, you know. Fine, we'll do a catch and release category for jacks. I was like, yes. I called Mike Holiday at Bahio. I said, hey, man, could you sponsor, like, you know, give away some sunglasses or something to the winners? You know, we need some sort of incentive to really get this kind of category going. And guess what? 150 folks signed up for the jack or ball catch and release category. Because guess what? The fun part about catching a jack is the catching it part. It's not the eating it part. Next. Give this a shot. See if this will play. You guys probably have seen this. This is a video, and the sound's not going to play, but there's some incredible images that will show, or maybe not. But
if this doesn't work, I've got like 150 hours in Jackson.
Is it YouTube hyperlinked?
Yeah.
I got to reconnect to the Wi-Fi.
Oh, gotcha.
Maybe I can play it right before we start.
Yeah. So the nuts and the bolts of this, there's a guy, you guys may know of him, Jaco Lucas, has spent his career taking people to the Seychelles, to Cosmolitos, for a chance to cast on a giant trevally, right? At the tune of like $30,000. Well, what's the difference between a GT and a jack creval? Really, if you put them side by side?
They're cheaper.
Kind of the same thing, right? Right. So what started occurring to me, man, why aren't we being a little smarter here in the northern Gulf of Mexico? Why don't we market jack creval as our own GT, right? And have these, have the chance to have people get excited and pay money and book guides for a chance to go out and throw on a jack creval. Well, that's exactly what this guy Jaco said. And so he's switched his entire business model from taking people to the Seychelles. He now lives in Austin, Texas, and guides out of Port O'Connor, Texas, specifically taking people to throw on jacks. And just like Cody, this guy stays busy, right? So on the one hand, we can consider jack creval a trash fish. We used to consider great triggerfish a trash fish. They're delicious, of course, right? We used to consider tarpon a trash fish. Or we could be smarter about it and say, man, there's a real opportunity to have a market and a population that's excited about jacks, just going out and catching them and releasing them. So where do we go from here? Well, continue and expand the conventional tagging program with ASGA and angler advocates, right? Guys that are excited to go out and catch jacks, putting in those conventional tags, it's a very light lift. It's not difficult. And if we get enough of those tags out, we'll start getting some recaps and get really good information from that, right? Secondly, it'd be great to increase the acoustic tagging efforts across the Gulf of Mexico. Carissa, she was one lady, one graduate student, put out all those tags in South Florida. Next thing you know, they're swimming across the Gulf. So she sends me some tags. I don't know if you saw the little blue ones up in Mobile Bay. She said, hey, can you tag some of these fish in Mobile Bay? I said, sure. So we've now gone to Texas. Last week, we put out 7 transmitters on Jackson, Texas. When we download these receivers, we expect to see these fish doing all kinds of movements. We need someone to sit down and synthesize this existing data set. So what are these jacks doing? What does that mean for their movements and migrations? And I'd say, most importantly, we need to make our voices heard. if jacks are important to you and your business like they are to the guides and the Lower Keys Guide Association, let's say something about it. Let's tell the Jasons and the Chrises of the world, hey, these jacks are important. And that's exactly what Carissa and Jen have done with FWC. They've approached FWC and said, hey, listen, these jacks are a big deal, and not just to us as scientists. They're not just a scientifically big deal. They're important to people's bottom line. So let's be proactive rather than reactive. So with that, I want to thank you guys for listening to me blabber, and I'd be happy to answer any questions at all about Jack Herbal.